The Second World War. So today's is the first lecture. We're talking about the Second World War, so 1939 to 1945, the war, and then a little afterwards, what happened after the war. I'm not going to give you a military history of the Second World War. When were the biggest tanks used? Which cities were bombed when? This is not my idea. I'm going to try to give you an impression of British life in Britain during the Second World War. What were the big questions, the big debates, the big conflicts? If you look at British films about the Second World War, this is probably the best way to not learn history about the Second World War. British films about the Second World War are very impressive. The Russians did nothing, which is not really very fair. The French resistance does not exist. The Americans came too late. And the British won the war all alone, on their own, with nobody with them. This is the British war film, which is, it's good films, but it's not really good history. So let's have a look. And I have to go back before then the war to Prime Minister Chamberlain. Who was then a Conservative. He became Prime Minister in 1937. Before that, he was Minister for Health. And became Prime Minister then in May 1937, not a good time to become Prime Minister. Yeah. Hitler was already in power in Germany after 1933. The Spanish Civil War had begun in 1936. General Franco revolted against the elected government, and the fight was going on, very, very hard fights. Yeah. So fascism was abroad in Europe. It's the kind of time when it's good to be a university professor and not prime minister. But he became prime minister at this time. And there was already open, to some extent, the question of whether it was necessary to oppose Germany. The elite were very divided. Of course, as you know, in France, the elite were very divided and eventually decided, most of them, not to to take the war seriously and to join Mr. Pétain. In Britain, the elite were divided, but also the government had another problem. It was only 20 years since the First World War. Only 20 years later. The First World War, by this time, was widely considered to be a terrible waste. And he did actually think, if I decide to declare war on Germany, will the people follow? So there was a real practical problem. Yeah, it wasn't obvious. But eventually, it would, of course, happen. But not before Chamberlain negotiated with Hitler and tried to find a peaceful solution. And very famously, the poor man, this is the only thing that people remember about Chamberlain. He went to Germany, negotiated with Hitler, and came back, and there's this wonderful scene. He gets off the plane with a piece of paper. I have here the signature of Mr. Hitler, and this document signifies peace in our time. Fail, yeah? Okay, so, of course, it's very easy for us to, oh, he was wrong, but, you know, that's the only thing people remember about Chamberlain. And so he was convinced that it was possible to find an agreement with Hitler, and in fact the expansionist principle of Nazism made it impossible, and so Hitler occupied Prague, and then of course invaded Poland, and the declaration of war came on the 3rd of September 1939. For the first few months, Chamberlain then was the head of the war government, a coalition government, the different parties together. And the coalition government, this is important because you had a government with the Conservatives and the Labour and the Liberals. And so the government had to make some concessions to keep Labour inside. They didn't really want an opposition during wartime. So that was very important. In any case, the first years of the war were a disaster. The British forces attacked the Germans in Norway and lost terribly. That's all the military part of the war I'm going to tell you about. Chamberlain resigned and was replaced by By who? Winston Churchill. Yes, I get Winston Churchill. Now, Winston Churchill, let's have a look at Winston Churchill. First of all, very, very, very funny man. I have a few famous quotations from Winston Churchill to give you an idea. He said, "History will be kind to me because I intend to write it." Yeah, he's got a certain style, and he did. He, after the war, he wrote a history of the Second World War in many volumes, very well written, very, very good book. He was also a very intelligent man and very, very sharp. Apparently he used to be very, very fast with the repartee, and I have two stories about him. A lady said to him, "Mr. Churchill, you are drunk," because he did like the brandy. And apparently he said, "Yes, madam, and you are ugly, but tomorrow morning I will not be drunk anymore." So, you know, it's obviously quite a vicious guy. Just one more. Another lady, it's always against ladies, says, "Mr. Churchill, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your tea. Madam, if you were my wife, I would drink it." You know, so obviously a really quite sharp guy. But a very surprising Prime Minister, really, because if Winston Churchill had died in 1938, before the war, he would have been remembered as a failure. Everybody remembered him as a very conservative man, the man who sent the troops against the workers in Wales in 1911, the man who organised the attack at Gallipoli, a terrible disaster, a very, very bad idea in the First World War, the man who had no political friends at the end of the 1920s, who hated Gandhi, who was extremely racist about Gandhi, and no other word for it. You should read some of what he writes. And so if he had died in 1937, he would have been remembered as a failure. But he didn't die in 1937. And one thing that certainly he had always believed throughout the late 20s and the 30s, he always believed there will be a big conflict with Germany. We cannot avoid a big conflict with Germany. Now, we don't know if that's true. We know there was a big conflict with Germany. We don't know if it was inevitable. But in any case, of course, at this moment in 1940, he was taken out of retirement to become then the Prime Minister of the war. And certainly a tremendously determined man. I mean, I suppose if you're going to organise a war, you need somebody who's really pretty tough, yeah? So, for example, when things were going bad in the war, Winston Churchill never imagined surrendering. He said, no, the government moves to New York. We have a government in exile in New York. We continue the war. That was the attitude of Winston Churchill. He had decided there was just one way. Yeah. And so he becomes Prime Minister. So let's see a little. So certainly he was very talented. In May 1940, he made one of his most famous speeches, "I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweats." So he made these inspirational speeches by the radio, because of course the radio now was suddenly very important. In 1939, not everybody had a radio, but maybe in every street there was a radio. So it was a completely new technology, right? It's tremendously important, the radio. And he made these inspirational speeches, in particular this one, which is very well known. "I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat." This is very interesting, because in the First World War, the politicians talked about glory and sacrifice. Very glorious discourse. In 1940, it was impossible to give a glorious discourse. Nobody would believe it. They saw the First World War. Yeah. So glory was not impossible. And so I think it was very intelligent of Winston Churchill to take this not very positive, you know, "I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat." It's not very exciting, is it? Blood, toil, tears and sweat. So I think he did understand a lot of things about how to get people through. Now, even today, it's quite difficult to analyse the objectives of the First World War. Sorry, the Second World War. It can't really be said to be a war for democracy, because the British continued being friends with Franco and other dictators after the war. It can't really be considered to be a war for Poland, Of course, the immediate reason for the British entering the war was that Hitler invaded Poland. What happened to Poland at the end of the war? Anybody remember what happened to Poland at the end of the war? We gave Poland to Stalin. Yeah, well, it's probably better than Hitler, but, you know, not a lot of fun. Yeah. So it's not really a war against fascism. Salazar, the Portuguese fascist leader, was an ally. So, not quite as clear as all that. Nevertheless, from the point of view of the people being involved in the war, popular anti-fascism was very important. That one of the motivations that got millions of people to continue despite the terrible bombing. The Second World War, very different from the First World War. In the First World War, if you were a civilian, you probably ate better at the end of the war than at the beginning. In the Second World War, most of the people who died were civilians in Britain. I'm just only going to talk about Britain because of the bombing. Bombing cities was the big thing. Okay, so first, the development of the war, number one. For the first months of the war, not very much appears to happen. This is what you call in French le drôle de guerre. Drôle de guerre. On est en guerre, mais en fait, il ne se passe pas grand-chose. In English, we call this the phony war. Phony, P-H-O-N-E-Y. That's the false war, the pretend war. Because it was just, nothing happened. It was business as usual. Everybody went on holiday. Although, preparations were continuing. The German army had invaded Poland. They passed a new law which meant that Jews were not allowed to live anywhere. They had to live in the special ghetto, the special Jewish part of town. And as we know, this is a story which will have a terrible ending. But in Britain, there was no real attack prepared immediately. France believed that the what we call the Maginot Line. The defensive line was strong enough. There was no problem. Not good. Yeah. In Britain, most time was spent on preparing the war. They were very frightened of bombing. Everybody was very frightened of bombing. They had no experience of mass bombing of cities. And it's very interesting that the government didn't understand what the effect would be. For example, they imagined that a large proportion of the population would go mad, that psychologically it would be impossible to stand. And they were prepared, the plans that they wrote were for hundreds of thousands of people just cracking up. And this did not happen. In fact, people seemed to survive psychologically better than you would imagine. But anyway, they began to prepare for bombing, so they put up balloons. The balloons to make it difficult for the aircraft. Yeah, big balloons very high up. That obliges the aircraft to fly very high, and so their bombing is not so accurate. They were very frightened of gas. In the First World War, gas was very important in the trenches. And in the Second World War, many people believed that the Germans would drop gas bombs on the cities. In fact, they didn't. I don't know why. But as a preparation, the pillar boxes, the letter boxes in the streets, were painted with a special yellow gas, which changes colour. Sorry, with a special yellow paint, which changes colour if there is gas. So this was the preparation. Everybody had to carry a gas mask. Yeah, something that. Yeah. My mother tells me that my mother was 6 years old, and they had to practice in the school putting on your gas mask and going down the road to the shelter. They thought it was a lot of fun. And a very, very serious campaign against the gas mask. If you went to the cinema, they wouldn't let you in without your gas mask. Yeah? It was a public safety thing. The other big preparation was the evacuation of children from the towns. In fact, 800,000 children and 500,000 pregnant women, people had a lot of children in these times, were evacuated from the towns. And very, very quickly. It was literally they put up a sign, bring your children to the train station on Saturday at 11 o'clock and we will take them to the countryside. And it was so massive. And of course everybody was very frightened, but they wanted their children to be in safety. And this was a very interesting social experiment, actually, not deliberately, but of course in the towns, they're mostly working class people. Now, when they went to the villages to say, do you have a spare room? The people who had a spare room were not rich, but really middle class people. And so you have this incredible social mix that you got all the working class people out of the, all the poor children out of the towns and put them in the houses of middle class people. So everybody learned a lot of things. I don't know if you've seen any of the Narnia films or the Narnia books. That is taken. The story is when they've been evacuated. There's some horrible stories with this because some children, when they were 12 years old or 13 years old, they were evacuated, and when they came back after the war, they couldn't find their parents. This was partly because the attitudes were not the same. Yeah, that some parents thought, oh well, now they're 14, they're adults. Yeah. Remember, you leave school at 14, you start work, and so especially poor people who didn't have a lot of money, so well, you know, we won't go and get them back. You know, c'est quite c'est déprimant. Hein? On va en vacances, on revient, les parents ont déménagé. That's sympa. Yeah, you had terrible stories like that. And on the 1st of January, 2 million men aged from 20 to 27 were called up to join the army. So again, here's something completely new. In the First World War, the British Army was, from 1914 to 1916, a volunteer army. In the Second World War, you had immediate conscription. And that seemed to be more or less accepted. The situation in the war by June 1940, after almost a year, was of course very, very bad. In May 1940, the British ran away from Dunkirk and went back to England. More than 300,000 soldiers, 200,000 British and 100,000 French, were rescued from Dunkirk. It became a myth, the retreat from Dunkirk. They were stuck in Dunkirk, the army. They couldn't get away. And what they did is that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of small boats came from Britain to take the soldiers away, and this was successful. And it was presented by the government as a victory. Yeah, that we got all these, the British spirits organised all these boats to go and take the people away. But as one politician said, you don't win wars by running away. Yeah. And it was a terrible defeat, really, in Dunkirk. Also, the defeat is they successfully rescued the soldiers. What did they do with the guns, tanks? What did they do with them? What did they do before they left them? What would you do? They destroyed the guns. Yeah. They couldn't take them with them, but you don't leave them. Here's a present for Mr. Hitler. No, they destroyed all. In fact, the British Army destroyed 80% of all its equipment because they didn't have any choice. You can't give it as a present. But you know that meant that in June 1940, when Pétain signs an agreement with Hitler, the British have their army back in Britain and with almost no equipment. So the situation is looking pretty bad. For a moment, it looks like Britain will surrender. For a few weeks, it appears possible. One section of the government said, we need to contact Goering and we need to discuss what are the terms of surrender. What do we need to do to surrender? Because we have no army equipment and France has stopped. So this is not looking good. And Russia is not yet is in an agreement with Hitler. So bad. The United States is not interested for the moment. So it looked pretty bad. But there was a big debate in the government, and Winston Churchill won. Winston Churchill won the debate, and there was not a surrender. But I think it's important to remember the surrender was not impossible. It didn't happen, that whenever you're studying history, you have to be very careful not to imagine that everything that happened was inevitable, because it wasn't. There were many things could have been different. Meanwhile, the British had some difficulties with their empire. In India, a lot of the army in the Second World War came from India. But there was a little problem here, because India was not a democracy. It was controlled by the British, and so the Indians were obliged to join the war, if they wanted to or not. But at this point, the Indian independence movement said to Churchill, "We will send many more soldiers if you promise independence after the war." So it became political. And I think this is important, that politics does not disappear during a war. It just continues in another way. Okay, where are we up to? The Blitz. The next military episode of the war is the Blitz. What's the Blitz? Well, it's the bombing. It's the bombing of Britain. And it continues for... I don't know how long, for several months. All the houses in the cities have to black out the windows. Yeah, you need to stop any light from getting out, because if the aeroplanes cannot see the lights from the cities, then they don't know where to bomb. Yeah, so that's a sort of sacred thing. And the other question, people were very tired, because volunteers stayed up all night to watch for fire watching. And the government wanted everybody to build a shelter in their garden. You know that many, many English people have a small garden. It's very, very traditional English to have a small garden, even people who are not rich. And so the government had a campaign for individual shelters in the garden, the Anderson Shelter, it was called. I have a little video about this, which I will put you on my blog. And the whole question about sheltering was very political, because, you know, if you imagine you're in London and you know there's going to be a lot of bombing, where would you hide? Where would you go? So again, in the subway, in the metro, in the underground, yes, it's obvious. The government refused to open the underground stations at night. So no, we don't want to. It does sound rather bizarre and rather cruel, doesn't it? Can anybody imagine the reason? That's not a good question, actually, because you won't guess the reason. I'll tell you the reason. Well, the government was very worried that if people went down into the underground to escape from the bombing, they wouldn't come back. They wouldn't come back up in the morning and go to work. They'd just be so frightened, because the bombing is really, really horrible. Yeah? And they were really frightened that they couldn't trust people to get together in collectives. They were worried that in a collective shelter there could be a revolt against the war, and that people would refuse to continue. And of course, if people don't go to work, they can't produce the guns and the tanks and the uniforms and the food for the army. So that was the reason. But there was a big campaign, and the Communist Party was very much involved in the campaign, where they demanded that the underground be open, and that the campaign was successful. And so after that, the underground was open. It was not easy, because what you had to do is, so you could come up in the morning and go to work, then at lunchtime, one of your children would go and join the queue for the underground shelter and stand there all day. And then when you finish work, you come and join them in the queue. You know, the English, they love queuing. Yeah? And so really people waited for 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours every day to go into the underground. Yes, a very extremely tiring situation. Outside London, there was another phenomenon which was very impressive, and that is what we call trekking. C'est pas le trekking. Okay. For example, Manchester. Now, in Manchester, there is no... there is no underground. Yeah, so you can't go in the underground. There's no underground. If somebody says, queue here for the underground, they're lying. There's no underground. Okay. So what did they do in Manchester? Well, what people did is they went to work, and when they finished work at 6 o'clock, they walked out of the town 10 miles, 15 miles, to sleep in the fields, because you're safer in the fields. You know, the bombs are for the cities. And then walked back in the morning, because they were frightened, yeah? They went to hide at night. And the government was not happy with this, because they thought it was bad for morale, but it was very, but they couldn't, the government couldn't stop people doing it, democracy. And so trekking was very important too. There were other conflicts about sheltering. A campaign of people from the east of London went to occupy the basements in the west of London. The west of London is rich. The big shops in Oxford Street have a basement. Very good place to save. And of course, it was illegal to go there to hide, but people said, it's illegal, but they're going to kill me, so I'm coming anyway. Yeah. So there were quite a lot of tensions around sheltering. In any case, the result was massive. In one day, somebody counted one day, there were 170,000 people sleeping in the underground. So this was quite a lot of people. In any case, in 2 months, there were 100,000 bombs dropped on London. And most houses in London were damaged. Most houses were damaged. So people were really in quite a bad way. And even worse than London was the town of Coventry. An industrial town in the middle of the country was destroyed. It was destroyed. There's almost nothing left of Coventry. And today, if you go to Coventry, you can go to Coventry Cathedral. I think it's the cathedral, yes. And they have maintained it in the same state. You have the front and the rest has disappeared. But they didn't repair it because it's a monument to peace. They kept it as a monument to peace. In total, 50,000 civilians, 51,000 civilians were killed in the bombing. 51,000 civilians were killed in the bombing. However, just to compare, more British pilots were killed bombing Germany. 59,000 British pilots were killed bombing Germany. And if you do the mathematics, you understand there were far more people killed in Germany by bombing. This is fundamentally a reason of technology. The British radar was better, and so that after a while they managed to stop the German bombers from coming close, or make it much more difficult. And of course, Germany is much bigger, and so Germany is easier to bomb. And so Dresden disappeared. The situation was even worse over there. Now, this was interesting because it was also a political question. In the 1920s in Britain, there had been big campaigns, no bombing of cities. And these campaigns said, okay, sometimes we have a war, but in wars, soldiers should fight soldiers, and it's immoral to bomb cities. This was a big campaign with petitions and so on. But however, once the war began, and once the bombing began in Britain, that was a very difficult position to keep. And certainly the government in Britain did quite the opposite. They said, you know, yesterday we sent 1,000 bombers to Berlin. They didn't tell them what they were doing tomorrow. That's war, yeah. So they made a big publicity, say, you know, yeah, now let's have a big party because we sent 1,000 bombers yesterday. That was the atmosphere. Yeah, so it's not a very, passive. It was a difficult time to be a pacifist. Yeah, so that was the kind of situation. A lot of chaos. The bombing caused a lot of chaos. Some small towns that were being bombed, and they'd sort of get up in the morning and say, okay, where's the chief of police? He's run away. Where's the mayor? He's run away too. You know, there's a lot of chaos going on. You know, people were not. It's a democracy. It's not a military thing. You can't. I suppose you probably could oblige the policeman to not run away, but a lot of people ran away, you know, because they were just so terrifying. Rationing, utility, and total mobilization. So once you get to a war like the Second World War, the mobilisation, well, the British elite learned in the First World War that you win if you mobilise the whole population. War is an economic, conflict, because if your country has enough people and money to make more tanks and bullets and uniforms and ships, then they win. You know, so it's an economic side. And so the mobilization of the entire population is very important. And this was learnt slowly in the First World War. At the beginning of the First World War, they didn't understand this. And after 2 years, they began to say, oh yes, we need women to work in the factories. It was very slow because they had strange ideas about what women should and shouldn't do. But in the Second World War, they very, very quickly went to total mobilization and rationing. So rationing is, of course, an idea where you can't buy, you can't just go and buy meat. You have a ticket. You're allowed to buy 1 kilogram of meat every month for you and 1 kilogram for your children. Okay, so this is rationing. Very interesting. In the First World War, rationing was introduced in 1918. Yeah, at the end of the war. Now, rationing was introduced very quickly in the Second World War, and rationing, you need to understand, is a democratic measure. Because in wartime, there is not enough meat, because the ships cannot arrive from Argentina. You know, there is not enough of everything. And so, if you don't have rationing, the rich buy all the meat, because the prices go up, yeah, because there's not enough. And so rationing, although it appears from one point of view to be a constraint, it's a democratic measure. Everybody will get half a kilogram of meat a week. Whereas if you don't have rationing, the price goes right up. Because of course we always imagine, especially in Britain, we always imagine that everybody was together and united in the war. That, of course, that doesn't exist. That doesn't exist. You've got people who said, oh, well, in my I have a nice, I live in a nice small town, there are no bombs. I will rent you my house for £3,000 a week because you live in London where there's bombs. A lot of people wanted to make money. It's just like any situation. You never get a situation where everybody is good. You get everything in wartime, bravery, but also, you know, people just trying to make money out of it. So the rationing importance. They also introduced a national identity card. This is a card which has your identity, and you must carry it with you everywhere. And if a policeman asks you for it, you must show it to them. Yeah, I know it sounds ridiculous. I'm joking, of course, because in Britain we only have identity cards when there's a war on. And this is a big cultural difference with France. When I say to my British friends, I say, in France, everybody must carry an identity card. And my British friends say, oh, yeah, a fascist country. Okay. Yeah. It's absolutely impossible. There's a very interesting recent story here, because Tony Blair wanted to introduce identity cards in Britain. And it was very unpopular. And so he said, well, let's do it little by little. And so originally they introduced voluntary identity cards. Of course, you know, nobody was interested. And eventually they have abandoned the idea. There are still no identity cards in Britain, and it's not possible. So, I think the British attitude is, here is a policeman. He doesn't know who I am. This is not my problem. This is his problem. He doesn't know who I am. What an ignorant person. If he wants to know who I am, he can ask me. I'll tell him. It's very British. There you go. But in the wartime, they had an identity card, and they also had utility. What is utility? Very simple idea. You see, the idea is, during the wartime, they wanted to be able to use the maximum number of workers and money and so on to produce for the war. Yeah. We need workers making tanks and guns, so we want the minimum number of workers making clothes and chairs and all the other things you need. And so what they did is the government imposed the rules about making clothes, for example. For example, women's coats. The government said, okay, we are going to make 3 varieties of women's coats in this country, that's all. Of course, this is much more efficient, because if you make 100 different varieties because of fashion and so on, it's wasteful. And so the government, now to make it acceptable, the government phoned up well-known designers and said, we want you to design three, but only three, women's coats for the utility. And those were the only coats that you were allowed to sell. The same thing with furniture, chairs and so on, only utility furniture. So the idea is for, in many kinds of consumer goods, to reduce choice, in order to make the industry more efficient, and therefore in order to allow more space for my notes have disappeared. More space for the war industries. They also introduced maximum prices by law. So in some ways, Britain became like Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia. Britain became a state capitalism. The state controlled everything during the war. So before the war, in 1930, if you are you have a factory, you're a boss, you have a factory. What do you make in the factory? Anything you want that you think can sell. During the war, the government said, right, you must produce this. So this is what we call state capitalism, and it's one of the strange things about wars. In some ways, you need to resemble your enemy. You need to be parallel. Yeah. So of course, in Nazi Germany, it was not democratic, so they could just order people to do everything. But in Britain, they also had to order people to do everything. Very, very controlled, and people had to work very long hours, very, very long hours. So in fact, living in London in 1943 was probably in some ways similar to living in Petrograd or Berlin, yes? Very, very long hours work, a lot of control. So it was one of the effects of the war. Utility furniture, utility. I've got my order a little wrong now. I'm going to stick this put it up here. There you go. It's moved now. Okay. A little thing about social change. One of the social changes was a relative increase in social justice. Now this sounds a little strange, but if the government wanted to mobilize everybody to support the war, to work for the war, and to do this, they were obliged to introduce some measures of social justice. For example, the income tax on rich people went much higher during the war, much, much higher. And for the poor children, during the war, they introduced free milk for children, free vitamins. Partly this was a practical question because they needed young men who were in good health to join the army. Also, during the war, the number of members of trade unions rose very quickly. Now, more and more people joined trade unions during the war. So, another big change, just like in the First World War, but possibly even more profound, was the change in the position of women. In 1939, about 500,000 women worked full-time. In 1939, about 500,000 women worked full-time. In 1945, 7 million. So the number of women working full-time was multiplied by 14. You can see I should have been a maths teacher, not a history teacher. In some ways, quite a number of women found the experience of the Second World War to be rather liberating, because suddenly you were allowed to do all kinds of jobs which previously had been reserved for the men. One of the innovations of the war years was the Women's Land Army. L'armée agricole. Because they wanted all the men to join the army, they said, okay, you women, you come and work on the farms. Now, it was difficult at first, because if you don't know much about farms, it's not very easy. But in fact, a lot of women, although the work was very hard, but a lot of women felt that they had more, they had more money, they had more wages, and also they had more independence. one of the big debates about the Second World War is how much did the changes for women continue after the war? I don't have the answer to this one, I just have the question. So let's have a look at opposition to aspects of the war. Well, there was a certain amount of support for pacifist organisations. In the 1930s, an organisation had been established called the Peace Pledge Union. This was after the First World War. In fact, in 1934, a popular priest, he was called Dick Shepherd, a popular priest from the Church of England, wrote a letter to the Times to establish a new organisation, the Peace Pledge Union. It's a pacifist organisation. It still exists today. You can go and find its website. They didn't have a website in 1934. And the Peace Pledge Union is an interesting idea. A pledge is a promise. And to join the Peace Pledge Union in 1934 or today, you write a pledge. I renounce war and I will never support or sanction another. Signed. Bill Clinton. Dick Shepherd, the leader, had been in the First World War and found that it was not very nice. And so the Peace Pledge Union had quite a lot of influence. In 1935, they had 100,000 members. 100,000 members. Dick Shepherd died in 1937, but the movement continued, and some very famous people joined it. The novelist Aldous Huxley, for example. What did he write? Aldous Huxley? Thank you. Yeah, Le Meilleur des Mondes. Je savais qu'il y avait un livre que tout le monde a entendu parler, au moins. Vous n'avez pas forcément lu. Aldous Huxley, another novelist, Vera Brittain, and the poets Siegfried Sassoon. They were all members of the Peace Pledge Union. And it had a certain sympathy. It was a difficult position. During the Spanish Civil War, many people went from Britain to join the Republicans to fight against the fascist Franco. And the Peace Pledge Union said, well, no, we're pacifists, we don't want to, but they were very involved in helping refugees. Yeah, so it's a very active sort of thing. And the Peace Pledge Union in the war, they campaigned against the gas masks. They said, if you prepare everybody by wearing gas masks, you're actually encouraging the atmosphere of war. And during the war, they had a campaign against bombing cities. Yeah? They had leaflets, revenge is not the solution, la vengeance n'est pas la solution. Okay, as you can imagine, this is quite a difficult campaign to run during a war. Okay, so let's go on to the development of the war, part two. Similarly, in some ways, it's similarly to the First World War. You have a long period where there is no real progress, military progress on either side, and the dead end, the impasse, is solved when Hitler decides to attack Russia and to march on Moscow. Listen, take my advice. If ever you want to dominate the world, don't march on Moscow. It doesn't work. It's been tried. It doesn't work. Napoleon tried it. Disaster. Hitler tried it. Disaster. Don't do it. Go somewhere else. So, in 1941, October 1941, the German army advances on Moscow, and things begin to move very quickly. December 1941, the Japanese decide to enter the war, and they have a rather clever idea. They say, hey, let's destroy the American fleet first and enter the war the day after. Just thinking there. In Poland in 1943, April 1943, there is the Warsaw Uprising, a revolt against the Nazis. And finally, the big event for Britain, the Normandy landings, or as you say in France, le débarquement. Where the British, the Americans, the Canadians, the Australians all arrive in France on the same day. What a coincidence. Yeah, no, they did it deliberately. They all arrived in France at the same time. And this was quite late, really. This is 1944. Now, the Russians were unhappy because after 1942, the Russians and the Communist Party in Britain said, we need Britain to attack France because all of the force of the German army is on Russia. And of course, the number of Russians killed in the war is absolutely ginormous. I don't remember the numbers, but it's like 10 times more than the British. It's enormous, absolutely massive. And Stalingrad is the big battle there where millions were killed. Absolutely tremendously big thing. So, of course, attention, spoiler alert, Hitler lost, okay, and Hitler commits suicide in April 1945. Meanwhile, the American scientists are developing a new weapon, the atom bomb, which will be tested for the first time on the 16th of July, and then used for the first time on the 6th of August. So they're in a big hurry here. So the two atom bombs that fall on Japan, so far the only two nuclear bombs used in a war situation. So, at the end of the Second World War, it's finished. The war is finished now, and 360,000 British were killed. 360,000 British were killed in the Second World War. So not so many as the First World War, and far more civilians. Most of them are civilians, so a very different situation there. And this can be compared with millions of Russians. Was not the worst situation. Society has changed. The government's government organization of the economy is massive. The civil service, les fonctionnaires, sont beaucoup plus nombreux. Everything's organized. Unemployment disappeared during the war. So, just like in the First World War, many poor people had more money during the war than before the war because unemployment disappeared. And we estimate that in total, the Second World War cost 28% of British wealth. That is everything valuable in Britain. Yeah, all the houses and factories and roads and money and everything. 28% disappeared during the First World War. Also, one of the rather surprising, perhaps, elements about the Second World War is that the patriotism was often quite left-wing. Now, this has a history to it because during the First World War, whenever you have a war, the government wants people to continue in the war, and so the government generally promises things will be better afterwards. And so if you say, but before the war you didn't help the poor, so why will you help them after the war? Oh, I promise. Okay, so you can believe them or not. And in the First World War, the slogan of Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, was, homes fit for heroes. Nous allons construire des logements appropriés pour les héros. And the results were, there was a little change, but not much. But in the Second World War, this seemed to be even stronger. George Orwell was the famous writer. I will talk a little more about George Orwell at the time, but he wrote a document called The Lion and the Unicorn, a very left-wing, patriotic document at this time, The Lion and the Unicorn. And the other big events during the war was the Beveridge Reports. The beverage, so it's a government report. You know, when the government wants to make a law, first of all, they ask some experts to write a report. It's normal. And Lord Beveridge, have you heard of this this report?
Yes.
Yeah, somebody heard. Could you tell me something about it?
It was to create social laws.
Absolutely was. Absolutely correct, yes. Yes, it was. Yeah, healthcare. Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. It was a very ambitious plan to establish new social laws, free healthcare, money for unemployed people, more money for old people, etc. Beveridge spoke about the five giants. I can't remember all the five giants, but it was squalor, ignorance, poverty, etc. Yeah, the horrible things about society. And so they published this this report, government report, and it sold 600,000 copies. Now, it's a government report. Yeah. How many government reports did you read this year? It's too exciting, isn't it? Oh yeah, I must get the new government report. So it was a very surprising, it's very, very boring, like all government reports are. Yeah? But it sold a lot, it really caught the imagination. He was a liberal, Lord Beveridge. And the slogan he used was social protection from the cradle to the grave. That's the slogan. From the cradle. Yeah, a cradle is like a basket you put a child in. And a grave is like a basket you put a dead person in. Okay. From the cradle to the grave. And it was a massive success. And as we shall see, after the war, many of its recommendations were implemented. And you get this bizarre... there are some interesting questions here. Where did they find the money? They just lost all their money in the war. They had no money, so where did they find the money? One. Or, perhaps more important, why did they find the money? Now, this is a complicated question, but certainly one element is that the elites looked back at the First World War. At the end of the First World War, you have revolution in Russia, revolution in Germany, 2 years of general strikes in Italy, Biennio Rosso. Enormous strikes in Britain, including a police strike. Yeah? Revolution in Hungary. And so, really, the elite were very much convinced that the end of the war could easily be a revolutionary situation. And one of the conservative ministers, I think it was, said, if you do not give the people reform, they will give you revolution. Now, we don't know if he was right or not. He might have been wrong, but this was the impression of the elite. And I think that's one important element. Also, the number of members of trade unions was very, very high in Britain in 1945. The Labour Party had cooperated with the war, but they'd given conditions. And in general, the government had made a lot of promises, and people really wanted change to happen. And in a moment, in a few minutes' time, I will come on to this question then of the welfare state. But first of all, a little parenthesis about culture. Because we've looked there a little bit at the military aspects of the war, much more at the social and political aspects of the war. But I want to talk a little bit about culture. The Second World War was very good for British culture. Many Jewish people who fled from Germany came to Britain. Now, the British were not very generous. They didn't allow many people to come in, but they allowed some people to come in. And some of them were the greatest artists of the time. So you get people like the novelist Arthur Koestler, and the painter, Oskar Kokoschka. These were Jewish artists and an artist and a painter sorry, an artist and a novelist who came to Britain and produced some of the best work. Oscar Kokoschka I particularly like because he continued painting until he was 94 or something. I like people who do that. Expressionist painter. And Arthur Koestler wrote some really very, very interesting novels. Also, the great philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, Jewish guy, came from Germany to Britain at this time. I'll come back to culture in a moment, but the question of Jewish refugees in Britain was very, very, very heavy. At one point, in Poland in particular, a lot of Jewish people began to understand what was happening, and hundreds of them gave their children to tourists. They said, here's my child, please take them away. And they brought them to Britain. So we had thousands of children arriving in Britain with complete strangers. They just gave their children to tourists, which was, of course, a very intelligent thing to do. But, you know, as they had come in, pretty difficult. Okay, let's come back to culture. And I just want to have a little look at poetry in the Second World War. And there's a reason for this, because in the First World War, poetry was a very important part of culture. The First World War poets, Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, Rupert Brooke, help me here. No, okay. Even today, in Britain today, the most popular British poets are the First World War poets. It's perhaps a little surprising, but they still are. And I recommend you go and find them. They're pretty good. So where were the poets of the Second World War? Not so many. Perhaps to write poems, you need a new experience. But there were a couple of them. People like Alan Lewis and Keith Douglas. These are poets of the Second World War. Alan Lewis and Keith Douglas. And Henry Reed. Henry Reed. I will try to put on the blog one of the poems of Henry Reed's. One of the most representative poems of the Second World War is The Naming of Parts. It's a short poem by Henry Reed called The Naming of Parts. It's about being a soldier and going through the part of the training where you have to learn the names of all the parts of your gun. Okay, it's very, very good, very, very, very good, good stuff. So those are the poets, not so influential as the poets were in the First World War, but still something. Let's go back to the novels. Because around this time in the 40s in Britain, one of the most influential novelists is the one that I just mentioned to you, Aldous Huxley. But Aldous Huxley is a bit like George Orwell. He has one or two famous books, but I sometimes think that his best books are not so famous. And so Aldous Huxley has a lot of books going back a long way. He goes back a long way, 1921, Chrome Yellow. These are novels. I'll just give you three of them. 1932, Brave New World. Et le meilleur du monde en 32. Worth a read. And 1939, my favourite, After Many a Summer. This is Aldous Huxley. What Aldous Huxley was doing at the time. Okay, that's just to give you a few ideas. I like to